This is a podcast from RTE Radio 1.
Tonight with Vincent Brown on the programme this evening, we're going to talk about Jesus, the fascination with Jesus, who he was, what reliably we know about Jesus, when the idea that Jesus was God first emerged, what happened to him, and to what extent did Jesus change the world. But first, over to the newsroom for the 10 o'clock news. Tonight we're going to talk about Jesus, and we have with us several scholars of Jesus, among them being John Dominic Crossan, who's written several books on Jesus, also Sean Frayne, who's written several books on Jesus. We have David Hutchinson Edgar, who's lecturer in early Christianity at Trinity College Dublin, Margaret Daly Denton, biblical scholar, and in Limerick we have Eamon Conway, the Department of Theology and Religious Studies. Can we just get out of the way straight away, Sean Frayne, the question, how do we know for certain that Jesus even existed?
Well, I suppose we have written evidence from the ancient world, to put it simply. We have the internal evidence, of course, of the Christian Gospels, the Christian writings. But also we have external evidence from Greco-Roman writers, Tacitus, Suetonius and others, and as well as that we have in the Jewish rabbinic sources. Now, I suppose one of the things we have to think about, particularly it seems to me important, is that Jesus, if he had not existed, it would have been unlikely that so many opponents of his would have spoken about him. And we have plenty of evidence in the Jewish sources and pagan writer Celsus in the early second century, middle second century, talking about Jesus trying to present an alternative story to the story in the Gospels. They didn't say he never existed. They simply tried to discredit him in some way or another. So I think that would be the kind of argument.
Is there any contemporary source aside from the Gospels?
Josephus. Josephus is a first century Jewish source. Now, his evidence has been, I suppose you'd say, tampered with or improved by Christian scribes later. But I think most scholars today, serious scholars, would say that there is a basic core text there which speaks about him very simply and very briefly. He doesn't say a lot about him, and that comes as a kind of surprise, I think, to students of the Gospels later to think that, well, Jesus didn't seem to make the kind of impact as well that we Christians later would attribute to him or want to attribute to him in his own time, in his own day.
But of course, the rest of the world wouldn't have got to know about him for some centuries, that he would have been known obviously in Israel and a bit in Turkey and Greece and a bit in Rome, but otherwise Armenia and a few other places, but otherwise not much.
Well, I suppose, yeah, it depends a lot on how we trace the way in which the Christian missionaries moved around the world, you know. I think we are all taken in a way by Luke's account, which tells us about the move from Jerusalem via Asia Minor to Rome. But we do know that other early Christian missionaries moved in other directions, moved to Syria, to Armenia, as you mentioned already, and to other places as well, Georgia and so on. So we do get a kind of much larger map, if you like, when we look at some of the fragments and where the Gospels were translated later, to suggest that Christian missionaries moved in all directions, really, not just to the West.
Without intending to be disrespectful, I think you could say that Jesus is box office, in the sense that there is a massive fascination with him, and as evidenced by the popularity of the films depicting Jesus, and as evidenced, I suppose, by even the Da Vinci Code. Margaret Daly Denton, why do you think this fascination remains so strong in an era where people seemingly have lost interest in religion?
Well, I think that for Europeans, certainly, and I'm from New Zealand, but culturally European, I suppose, Christianity has been so foundational to European culture that I suppose that accounts for a lot of it.
But he said, yes, but when you look at the decline in religious faith in Europe, it's still surprising that the fascination with Jesus remains so intense.
Well, I think there certainly are a lot of people that still feel themselves drawn to God through Jesus in some way, and that would be what we would really call the church.
Even people who don't, you know, who, who, yeah. might describe themselves as atheists or agnostics, there's still that fascination with Jesus, I think, isn't there?
There is, yes, certainly.
I think, Vincent, in fact, the more, if you like, institutions, religion has been on the wane in Europe and in the First World. I think the search for origins, the looking for some kind of important figure, has become, I think, increasingly fascinating for people. Not just Jesus, but I think Muhammad as well, and Buddha and so on. I think there's a kind of search for foundational figures, if you like, in the world religions, and I think Jesus comes into that category as well.
Yeah. John Dominic Crossan is Professor Emeritus of Religious Studies in DePaul University in Chicago. He's also from County Tipperary, but also he was one of the founders, I think, of what's known as the Jesus Seminar. Dominic Crossan, your fascination, I suppose, derives from your profession.
Yeah, and I suppose I've been told, Vince, that I'm Irish and don't like the British Empire, and therefore I make up for Jesus who didn't like the Roman Empire. But actually, as distinct from the European situation, and maybe what Margaret said about New Zealand, part of the problem with the historical Jesus in the States at the moment, where I am writing, is that we're trying to get him back from Christians who've hijacked him to found their violence. So we have a very specific motive in some of our writings here at the moment.
Explain that a little.
Well, for example, the Jesus who appears in the entire Left Behind series coming out of the apocalypse is a violent Jesus who is going to return and exercise the violence of God. And in an addition, over the apocalypse, there are Christians who expect, with some glee, to participate in that violence of God and of Jesus. And I find that to be, in Christian terms, a sin against the Holy Spirit. To make Jesus violent is the one thing we can never do.
That's the vibe, though, of the book of Revelations, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And that raises the issue very much about whether the second coming is our Christian refusal to accept the nonviolent Jesus, and to mention him, of course, and to say he was nonviolent. But having done that, let's get on with normal life and get back to normal violence. So yes, it raises issues about the Book of Revelation for me, not just for the Left Behind series.
Who do you think Jesus was, Dominic?
Jesus was a Jew within Judaism, within the Roman Empire. And he was a Jew, my way of putting it succinctly, was that as a historian, I think of him as a peasant with an attitude, but as a Christian, I think of him as having an attitude that belonged to God.
In that way, was he uniquely distinctive, having an attitude belonging to God?
Uniquely is not a term we can use in any absolute sense ever. But yes, he did something which nobody else exactly had done. That doesn't make him unique, except in the sense of every human being is unique. But once you factor in time and place, and you must factor that in, and you factor in the Roman Empire as a possibility, then you can see what happened to Jesus as possible. Give him 100 years before and maybe 100 years after, and I have no reason to think that Christianity would ever have done what it did.
The Jesus Seminar has produced two books on Jesus, one of them being the sayings of Jesus and the other being the Acts of Jesus. And in going through the sayings of Jesus and the Acts of Jesus, you have categorized the various assertions made in the Gospels as improbable, possible, probable, and almost certain. That isn't quite the way you've done it, but how much of what is in the Gospels that talks about Jesus' actions or words can we regard as almost certainly true?
Somebody figured the whole thing out and they came up with 18%, which is rather deceptive. If you ask most people in the world today what do they know about Gandhi, they would probably be able to say the most important thing, namely that he opposed the British Empire in India nonviolently. So the point is whether the ones that we are claiming to be from Jesus historically reveal the character of Jesus, or whether they are simply random sayings that anyone might have made at any time. It's the content of the ones that are determinative, that we find constitutive.
Yes, but if any of one of the Gospels, say the Gospel of Luke, how much of that is reliable in its telling us what Jesus did and it's telling us what Jesus said?
Well, for example, Luke puts on the lips of the dying Jesus, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." My judgment as a historian is that Jesus did not say that. Luke knew Jesus did not say that. Luke is doing an exact summary of the character of Jesus, and I consider it to be absolutely accurate. Even though Jesus never said it, I cannot imagine a better way of summarizing his life.
But Luke says he said it, and was that a lie?
No, not at all. That was totally expected in Greco-Roman writing.
Or was it journalism?
Basically, it is the what would I call it, poetic license of the writer in the Roman world.
Journalism.
Yeah, to make the appropriate statement.
Propaganda.
I wouldn't use negative language like propaganda, though somebody else might, because it is accepted that if a general is addressing his troops before battle, he will make the following type of statement. Did anyone think he made it? Of course not.
Do you think Jesus said what he's attributed, what he's said to have said in the Sermon on the Mount?
Let me put it this way, only the most important parts. Yes, I think without a doubt Jesus said the material about turning the other cheek. I think Jesus said, "Blessed are the poor." I didn't say, "Blessed are the poor in spirit." That's Matthew's addition, I think. So, yes.
Do you think Jesus was born of a virgin?
Literally, no.
And what other way could he be born of a virgin? Or?
Well, the more important question is whether Matthew or Luke took it literally. In the world in which they lived, it was one of the ways of saying that this person's life reveals the character of God. And when it was said that Caesar, Julius, I'm talking about a Caesar Augustus, was born not of a virgin, Octavia had a child already, but was born by Apollo, you're making a claim, you're making a transcendental claim that this person incarnates divinity. The same claim has been made of Jesus, which makes it high treason.
Eamon Conway, do you believe that Jesus was born of a virgin?
Let me quote Joseph Ratzinger. He says, "The doctrine of Jesus' divinity would not be affected if Jesus had been the product of a normal human marriage." I think that's very interesting, actually. Even Joseph Ratzinger has been struggling with this one. He mightn't have said that if he realised he was going to be elected as Pope. But I think it's a much more complex issue than... I mean, what do you mean by virgin there? And what certainly did the evangelist mean?
Well, let me tell you what I know. A woman who has never had sexual intercourse...
I don't think,
or a man who's never had sexual intercourse, but in this instance, it's a woman.
I don't think any of the evangelists were trying to make a statement about sexuality. I think they were trying to make a statement about God taking unique and decisive intervention in human affairs, and they were using a language, and a particular symbolic language, a highly charged one, which we may not understand fully in our culture, to express that. I think that's what was going on. I don't think they were trying to make a statement about sexuality, though I do realise and accept fully that it has been used in that way by the church, and indeed accepted that way by people through generations.
Sean Frain, do you believe that Jesus was born of a virgin?
I think the story of the virgin birth is as we have it now. I can't tell you how he was born, but I think the story of the virgin birth as we have it is a later reflection along the lines that John Dominic has just been explaining. I think the way in which gradually people came to see Jesus, the human figure of Jesus, as of particular significance as regard to God. Now, I think it is...
So in other words, no.
No, yes.
Mary Denton.
Oh, yes.
Mary Daly
yes,
Denton.
No.
Margaret Daly Denton.
Well, when I think about these things, I always think it's important to remember that we're culturally a long, long way from the New Testament period. We've all sorts of information about biology and reproduction and genetics and things like that that they didn't have in the ancient world.
They didn't actually know how babies came about.
No, well, for example, they believed that it was only the man that had any, if you like, input into a child, that the woman was simply a vessel, you know. And I think if they knew what we knew, they wouldn't have gone that way about trying to say who Jesus is, which is what they were trying to do, because they wouldn't have wanted to have a human mother.
So you don't think Jesus was born of a virgin either?
Pardon?
So you don't think that Jesus was born of a virgin either?
I think it's a symbolic narrative that we're dealing with here.
No,
it's not biology.
Well,
yeah, okay. Not biologically, no.
David Hutchinson Edgar, what about you? Please say yes.
Yes, of course. I think the important thing here, and I think it's what's coming out in what the other contributors have been saying as well, is that in the ancient world, storytelling was a major way in which people expressed meaning about who they were, about how they saw the world, about how they envisioned a better world. I think that's really what's going on in the Gospels. As Morgan said, it's not about genetics. But in the story,
you're saying no to.
In the story world that the Gospels create, saying that Jesus was born of a virgin and all the other things that go into the stories about Jesus' birth are about helping us imagine a different kind of world. It's not about genetics. It's about imagining a world where God favours the humble and the lowly, like in Luke's Gospel, where God's Son is to be born not in mighty palaces and to kings and so on.
All right. But do you believe that Jesus was born in Bethlehem? I ask you that because of the time of year.
Possibly. Some of the evidence that we have points in that records it in that direction. It's also quite possible that this is a picking up of the idea that the Messiah is to come from the line of David and from therefore from Bethlehem, from the house of David and so on. It's therefore equally possible that Jesus was born and grew up in Nazareth or where he's in the Galilee region where he's later associated.
In the early stories of Jesus, Margaret, and the story about the confrontation in the temple where he confronted the wise men in the temple, is that likely to be true?
As a child?
Yes.
I don't know. My faith certainly wouldn't rest on it.
I thought we'd ask to have Catholics in this program. You're probably about either.
You're the only Catholic here, Vincent.
Come on.
I would be looking beneath the story to try and understand what the author is wanting to say. Like as David said, making the story run so that Jesus gets born in Bethlehem is a way of connecting Jesus with David. So it's a way of saying the hopes of the people of Israel that were kind of bound up with David that had to do with the hope for some kind of a re-establishment of David's rule were, according to their faith, answered in Jesus.
Okay, do you think that he was baptized, Sean Friend, by John the Baptist?
Well, I think we're getting onto fairly solid historical ground at this stage. And yes, I think...
You mean that we're on historical weak ground up to this?
Well, I think the infancy stories are less concerned with history and much more interested in providing the scene, if you like, for their telling the story of the adult Jesus and his public ministry. And so the story you're just talking about, the story of Jesus in the temple as a 12-year-old, is foreshadowing, if you like, what's going to happen in the main part of the story. He goes from Galilee to Jerusalem, he encounters the centre of Jerusalem, and he is the wise person. So it kind of foreshadows what's going to come later. That's Luke's story. Matthew has a very different set of stories to do with Jesus going down to Egypt, coming back from Egypt and so on. So there's a whole other symbolism at work there in the way that Matthew's going to tell the story. So I think we have to be aware that these are literary productions to introduce us to the main story. But back to your question about Jesus and John the Baptist. Yeah, I think certainly, yes, Jesus was certainly a disciple of the Baptist. And I think that's very clear in many ways, particularly in John's Gospel, where it actually says Jesus engaged in a ministry of baptism himself. And almost as a kind of a rival Baptist sect. At least some of John's disciples were a bit annoyed that Jesus was attracting so many people. And also Jesus says on one occasion, that he's being, who did you go out to the desert to see? There's nobody born of women greater than John the Baptist. I'm hearing there the voice of, as an old teacher, the voice of a pupil who's enamored of his teacher. So I I think, yes, Jesus was part of the Baptist movement. I think he moves away from that, and I think that's one of the interesting historical questions that I think people like John Dominic and, to some extent, myself and others have been raising. What changes, if you like, from Jesus being involved in that whole renewal movement that was associated with John the Baptist, expecting the day of the Lord to come soon and judgment to come on Israel, and therefore to prepare for that, to now a ministry of healing and teaching around the villages of Galilee. What brought about that shift of emphasis, if you like?
What do you think?
Well, I think there are several issues here. It seems to me that Jesus comes into Galilee and encounters a world that's gradually breaking up as he understood it, and suddenly finds in himself certain understanding of God and God's designs, if you like, in the present, and also some of his own healing powers. And so he engages in this ministry now of bringing, if you like, the kingdom of God to these people, rather than waiting for the kingdom that is coming. And I think that's the beginnings of his own, what I would call, what has been described at least, as his messianic consciousness, his awareness that somehow or other he has a special mission to Israel, and that his task is to somehow engage in that with Israel. And his election of the 12, for example, suggests this kind of symbolic regathering of Israel that had been broken and scattered.
Mm-hmm. About the baptism of Jesus, you know, it's interesting that John's gospel doesn't actually record that Jesus was baptized by John. And John has quite a different function in the fourth gospel. And I think you have to, when you're looking at these things, you have to keep in mind that the authors who wrote these narratives were steeped in the scriptures of Israel, and a lot of the characters that they are creating in the story kind of follow the outlines of characters from the Old Testament. While John the Baptist in Matthew, Mark and Luke is a kind of like an Elijah figure, he's more, I believe, like a Samuel figure in John's gospel. And just as Samuel the prophet was able to recognize David as the true king, you know, and the Holy Spirit came upon David when he anointed him, well, I think John the Baptist is a bit like that in John's gospel.
But how much
recognizing who Jesus is,
can you rely on any of this, that since you've all agreed that the gospel writers wrote in things that they thought would add luster to Jesus's fame, to what extent can we be sure that anything they say is reliably true?
Could I come in and ask for a moment?
Yes, yeah, sure.
They were very honest. There's four versions. They didn't call them four gospels, though, you know, I do it all the time. They said there's only one gospel according to Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. So they've told us there's only one gospel, which I'd summarize by saying something like no Lord but God or something like that. But they told us they're giving us versions. They knew we could read them, and there's four of them, so they're doing everything perfectly honest. They're writing gospel. We want history. That's our problem.
But, I don't know. To what extent would the gospel writers have been writing to agendas related to controversies that had arisen within the Judaic or Christian world at the time that they were writing the gospels?
I would say absolutely. Otherwise, they are not writing gospel, because gospel is good news. And as a journalist, you will know that news is news.
Really good.
If all they tell you is what's going on in the 30s, it might be good, but it ain't news.
Yeah, but then we're back to the question of reliability. How do we know that if any of this is true, or even if we accept that some of it is true, which bits are true? Dominic?
It's a thing called faith. Actually, I agree with what Sean said at the very beginning, that we're assured that Jesus existed, and things like he was baptized by John, he was crucified under Pontius Pilate. We have a basic story, which is as clear as anyone is. It requires an act of faith to say that in a world in which Caesar was called God and a Jewish peasant was called God, one is going to choose the Jewish peasant over the imperial lord. That's cannot be done by anything except an act of faith that I can see.
Could I come in there as well, Vincent? I just wouldn't want to give the impression that while it's an act of faith, it's not also reasonable. And our faith, I think, is very much based on reason. And, I mean, the scripture scholars there, whom you have, know far better than I do that, first of all, we had a church without gospels. We had a Christian community that existed without gospels. And the gospels gradually became written, I suppose, in the third of the first century. Those texts began to be put together. And what we have there really are not biographies. What we have there are ways of telling the truth. And so, you know, when you start saying, well, what here is true or what is reliable, I think what we're guaranteed, at least what Christians believe, is that the Gospels convey for us all that is necessary for us to know with regard to our salvation. That doesn't mean that there aren't errors in there, but whatever errors may be there about facts, they're not trying to give us certainties. They're trying to convey to us, I suppose, really what at least Christians understand to be at the heart of human life. And we haven't even begun
that. What's that?
Well, I think the understanding that in Jesus Christ, God's last word, if I could put it that way, we talk about Jesus, the word of God. In your introduction, you said Jesus is God. I mean, that's as heretical as it is true.
I didn't say I was. I posed a question.
Okay, yeah. Well, I think that's actually maybe where we should move to, because that's shorthand, and it's equally as misleading as it is revealing for Christians.
But okay, let's move to that.
Jesus is God's last word to humanity. That for human beings, something utterly ultimate is revealed for human beings in Jesus Christ, is what Christians believe. And it gives us a whole new sort of measuring stick for what it is to be a human being.
All right, we're going to take a break. Afterwards, we'll get to the issue of Jesus being God. We've got to the issue of Jesus being God, and I've raised this before in programmes, and Sean Frayne was present when I did, and it's this that if Jesus was God, it's something absolutely profound, for it shows, first of all, that there is a God, and secondly, that there is a God who intervenes directly in our lives to such a dramatic extent that takes the form of a human being and comes and lives among us. If that is so, why didn't Jesus tell us that in unambiguous terms while he was here?
If I can come in there, Vincent. I mean, I've lost count of the number of heresies in just what you said. But let me begin by just saying that, you know, three words, Jesus is God. It took 300 words in the Council of Chalcedon to say that. And even just to take those Christians who do go to Midnight Mass will hear in the wonderful preface of the Mass, they'll hear, in the wonder of the Incarnation, you have brought to the eyes of faith a new and radiant vision of your glory. In him we see our God made visible, and so are caught up in love of the God we cannot see. So, first of all, to say that Jesus is God is going to mislead us entirely. And I know we've allowed this, we've had an
isn't
awful price to pay
Nicene
for catechesis.
Creed. Didn't that Nicene Creed say that?
I think you'll find it a little bit more nuanced than that. But let me just say, I mean, are you saying that Jesus prayed to himself? I mean, it's a very different...
If he prayed, yeah.
But did he pray to himself?
Well,
who did he pray
if he,
to?
If he was God, he must have prayed to himself.
No, you see, that's... Now we're at the core of a complete misunderstanding of what Christianity is about, and of understanding the relationship between the humanity and the divinity. And it's great that we're there, because that is really the work that the churches have to focus on. It's we've let ourselves down badly on this one.
Well, let us up a bit well on this one, then. Explain.
Well, I would say the most accurate statement we have, if you even look at the beginning of John's Gospel, and Margaret Daly Denton and Sean Frayne and Dominic are much better on that than I am, but in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. It is the Word that became flesh and dwelt amongst us. So Jesus, the most accurate statement we can make as Christians is Jesus is the Word of God in flesh. Insofar as God...
What does that mean?
I'm trying to explain it. Insofar as God can give God's self away into the fragility of God's creation, can actually let go of God's self into the fragility of God's creation, that whole process of God's self-revelation, self-giving, gracious letting self go into God's creation, reaches its climax point insofar as 'tis possible for that to happen in that which is not God. It happens in the person of Jesus Christ. It happens in the person of Jesus of Nazareth.
You said at the outset of your remarks now that several of the things that I said were heretical. Mm. And among the things I said was that there is... I raised the question that if Jesus was God, It was something terribly profound.
No, no. What you said, what I was reacting to, is you said he took the form of a human being. Now it sparked off in me the particular heresy of phantomism or docetism, which was implying that he only seemed to be a human being rather than actually being a human.
All right,
being.
I didn't intend.
Sorry,
to
no, no, I don't.
All
again.
Right,
and
all
you're
right.
Forgiven.
All
forgiven.
Right, all right. It's okay. What other hereticisms was I guilty of?
Okay, can I come in on this for a second?
Yes, Dominic Crossan.
You really asked, you know, whether Jesus went around saying, I'm God, and jumping up and down.
No, no, I didn't say anything about jumping up and down. I was saying that if he was God, surely he would have said that in unambiguous terms.
Well, he said it in his language, not yours. He talked only and exclusively and especially about the kingdom of God, which is how others were being invited in to live like him with God. And that's what got him crucified. He wasn't crucified. If he went around saying, I'm God, like that, as he does in John's Gospel, to be honest with you, he probably would have had everyone laughing at him and thought he was nuts.
But do you think he was God? Do you suffer from that same heretical belief that Eamon Conway accused me of?
No, I think Eamon said it as well as I could possibly say it, that for Christians, again, I say for Christians, you can't get a better sight of what God is like in sandals than taking a good look at Jesus and trying to live like him, which they would have said.
But was he God? Dominic, was he God?
What? All right, okay, I'm going to play the game. Yes.
Well, why is that a game?
But I know that you don't mean it the same way as I do. Because if you take it literally, and you cannot take the phrase literally, when Jesus died, and he did die, then God died, and the world would have been in a bit of a mess for a short time on a Friday afternoon. So we're at a point where affirming something literally becomes as absurd as denying it literally.
Well said. Yeah.
Could I maybe help a little? Sorry, I'll be very brief. I think
Sean Frank.
If we begin to think about it as a process, Vincent, I think you're coming at the end of the process, and I think most of us are kind of on in the process, and you're coming at the finished bit of it, and you're asking us, is this kind of point where the church came to declare in the Nicene Creed, for example, that he's homoousios, of the same being with God, and so on. You're trying to somehow or other project that back onto the guy who walked around the shores of Galilee.
I am, yes.
Yes,
that's true.
And I think that's what a lot of people do, actually.
I'd say so.
And I think that's where we get into problems. The kind of problems that Dominic and Eamon are been illustrating, that it leads to kind of absurdities. Jesus, the Jesus who walked round the shores of Galilee, said the Shema every day as a good pious Jew. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one. He couldn't possibly, as a good Jew, have thought of himself as God. And in fact, when he's asked the question, he says, one is good, why do you call me good? One is good, God alone, echoing the Shema, or the great Jewish prayer. So I think we have to see Jesus is in that context. Now, one way to think about the subsequent process of development that will eventually lead 300 years later to the Nicene Creed is to begin to think that the early Christians are faced with a new and very vital experience that we could get into, but I don't think we have time to get into, namely, we'll call it shorthand the resurrection and the gift of the Spirit. They become to experience Jesus in a new kind of way. And in doing so, they begin to look for proper ways of framing him. And I use the word framing in a positive way, not a negative way.
No, Johnny Gall Gardy way.
No, certainly not. I've listened to all that. But clearly, and that gradually, as they move from the Jewish world where one is good, God only, and already with Paul you can begin to see the beginnings of it in a famous passage in Corinthians, I think it's 1 Corinthians chapter 8, he says, for us there is one God who is Father. So Paul is being Jewish at that moment. From whom are all things and for whom we exist. In other words, God is the source of everything and the end of everything. A one Lord Jesus Christ, through whom are all things and through whom we exist. So in other words, Paul is beginning to somehow or other bring the figure of Jesus and the person of Jesus and the transformation of Jesus into the ambit, shall we say, of the Jewish belief in God. And that process is going to continue, and it will continue further as we move it from a Jewish world into a Greco-Roman philosophical context, where suddenly language begins to mean something different. Son of God means something different to what it did in the Hebrew Bible, for example. So I think if we don't understand something of that gradual development, I think we're going to constantly create this problem of trajecting back onto the historical figure of Jesus, the later Nicene belief.
You're saying the Nicene Creed was wrong?
No, well, it's the end process of something that was, in its own way, Nicaea was trying to be as careful as possible, and I think Eamon made the point rather well, that it didn't mix up the two natures. It said they're perfectly separate. He's truly man and truly God. He's really man, in other words.
And was he truly God?
And truly God, they said yes, too.
Do you think that was true?
I think at the point that they are making that statement, they are making it within a particular philosophical context whereby it was one way to talk about Jesus and the effects of Jesus.
Do you think that is a proper way to understand Jesus now?
Well, I think it's a very difficult way. I think the church for a long time has operated with that kind of what has been described as monophysitism, namely that Jesus is truly God, Superman, playing at being human. I think our culture wants to see Jesus as rooted in the human experience, and I think that is perhaps a different emphasis, and we should begin there now to again contemplate what is the message of Jesus for our time.
You raised the issue of the resurrection, and can I put it to some of the others? Margaret, put it to you. Do you believe that Jesus died on Good Friday and rose from the dead, that he died as a human being on Good Friday and rose from the dead as a human being on Easter Sunday some days later?
No. Well, the actual chronology of that is symbolic. And as with the infancy stories, you know, we're dealing with profoundly symbolic narratives, but I believe the core of the thing is that Jesus died and was taken up in a unique way into the life of the resurrection, whatever you might call that. I mean, there was a belief.
I have no idea what it means.
No, I know we don't.
Why do you use words you don't understand?
Oh, we're all the time doing that. That's the nature of... That's what theological...
It sort of collapses communication, doesn't it?
No, it doesn't.
What theological conversation is about.
Jesus himself lived in a Judaism where not everybody believed that there was any such thing as a life after death. But there were a lot of people in the Judaism of Jesus' time who believed that there was the possibility of a life with God beyond death. And they called that the resurrection. And so Christians believe that in a unique way Jesus was taken up into this life with God. And I suppose the Easter experience that Sean is talking about, the Easter experience, I think, of Jesus believers at that time and nowadays as well, is that it wasn't just something that happened to Jesus, but that we can be connected to that we can be part of that ourselves through faith in him. And I think that that's because we believe that the Holy Spirit, the Spirit of God, was given, you know, to Jesus and to us. But
David, ask David Hutchinson Edgar, do you think Jesus rose from the dead? Using those words in the normal colloquial sense that they're understood, did Jesus rise from the dead?
I think in a conventional understanding of those words, we can say yes to that. But I think that's also the same way in which we can say yes to the way that poetry is meaningful or art is meaningful. I think it's highly significant that so much religious expression is artistic. Even the narratives about Jesus are an art form. They're stories. They're not propositions. They're not videotape. I think there is a dimension.
Going back to the Nicene Creed again, on the third day he rose again from the dead. Is that true or isn't it?
Is poetry true?
No. As a factual statement, no, it's not true.
It's a particular language of truth, or a vehicle for truth, Vincent. Could I just say something about this? Because I think the issue here is really what do we mean
Conway.
By, what do we mean by death, actually? And what's been said here is that death is no longer to be experienced by us as we normally experience it, which is as end and breakdown and disruption of life. But rather that, in fact, all of human life is taken in through Jesus into the experience of God. So death ceases to be that for us. And what's interesting about this is we're not dealing here with resuscitation, which I think is how we often understand or imagine that Jesus was brought back to life. He wasn't brought back at all. He was brought forward into a new way of life, which is actually the way we are meant to be, and which is restored to us in the life of Jesus.
So are the gospel stories that speak of Jesus appearing to the women, appearing to Saint Peter and one of the other apostles, and then appearing in the room along with the apostles, are those stories true or are they not?
With holes in his hands and his feet, which is all interesting. That, so it means it was the dead Jesus that appeared. In other words, his death was not rolled back in this.
Well, are these stories true or are they not?
But can I come in on this for
John
a second? The question
John
has relentlessly presumed that the literal is the same as the real.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm still in horror after you saying the poetry is not true. Then the parables of Jesus...
You guys should be at the tribunals here, you know.
Wait a minute,
this is like a tribunal.
You know that Jesus told parables. When he really wanted to get traction and get going, he made up a story. They're called parables. If you ask me, is the Good Samaritan true? I would say yes. I'd say yes. Then if you say, well, did it really happen? I'd say, I don't think...
Oh, no, that's fair enough. But did he speak the words attributed to him in relation to those parables?
No, but I'm saying that the early church made up parables about Jesus in the same way that Jesus made up parables about the kingdom. And the parables have truth. We were talking about Matthew and Luke's first chapters. Almost all of that is parable. Is it true? Yes.
Is it literally true?
Literally, no.
No.
Is it literally true?
No. But literal truth is not the only type of truth out there. In fact, it fills our newspapers and they fill the garbage in the evening. Mm-hmm. Literal truth, most of it, is gone by the end of the day.
You're confusing maybe truth with facts. I mean, facts are only one particular kind of truth, really.
Yeah.
They're the verifiable kinds of truth, aren't they?
Yeah. And unless you're in a court of law under accusation, they're probably very often the least important.
But they're the verifiable manifestations of truth.
Actually, that's an interesting... I mean, how do you verify love, Vincent? It's actually... Wittgenstein said that it is only love that believes the resurrection. I mean, how can you verify love? I mean, the most important decisions in our life are not made on the basis of verifiable facts.
Yeah, I'd have to think about that now.
while I'm thinking about it, we'll have a break.
We're talking about Jesus, and I've got more and more confused as the conversation has gone on, but I just want to ask a question. All of you skip around the question of, was Jesus God? You skip around questions, well, was there such a thing as the resurrection and all that? And you start groaning when I refer to these
matters.
So can I ask a question now? What was important or distinctive about Jesus? Sean Frayne.
Well, I think that... answer that question, of course, we have to look at the world in which he lived and what made him different. We already had a discussion about how he differed from John the Baptist. So what made Jesus different, I suppose, was that his vision... first and foremost, I would want to say that Jesus challenged the imperial powers of Rome as he experienced them in his own native Galilee.
So did lots of others.
Yes, indeed. But he challenged them in a particular kind of way, not by violence... not by heading for the desert, but by presenting a very different vision of what honour and truth and goodness was to that, and peace to what Rome presented. So I would see Jesus, the core for me, one of the core ideas about Jesus is that he presented a values revolution in terms of his own time. He had a different understanding.
Did he? Wasn't that the... did much of his message... was it not contained in the latter books of the Old Testament and in Greek philosophy?
Well, of course it was. Jesus, we've been just discussing the humanity of Jesus for a long time now in this programme. And one of the basic things we have to say, of course, is that as humans, we share a universal language in a way, but we share a particular cultural experience of what it means to be human as well. And Jesus, if we're going to say he's human, fully human, he had that experience, and he was, but his selection, if I might put it that way, his particular understanding coming out of that tradition is quite separate from other versions of it that we can compare it with in that period. And in that sense, I think Jesus brings a distinctive voice, a distinctive understanding about life from within that tradition, but at the same time is unique. Dominic mentioned earlier about Jesus the parabler. And I think he himself has written beautifully, Dominic has written beautifully about Jesus' parables, where they are metaphors, where challenging the assumptions that were part of everyday experience and subverting, if I might put it that way, the particular ways in which people thought about the world and thought about one another and so on. So I think in that sense we have to see Jesus as a very radical figure within his own tradition, drawing on certain images and ideas from within that tradition, but with his own unique voice and his own unique vision coming
Conway,
to expression.
Do you agree with that?
I do agree with that.
And what was unique about it?
I think that what's unique about Jesus is that he is fully human in a way that I am not yet, that I think most of us are not yet. And I think, just to add to that, that he reveals to us what it is to be a human being, but not only reveals it, but actually enables us to reach into the fullness of our own humanity.
You better explain that, because maybe all the listeners understand it, but I don't.
Okay, well, what I'm saying is that we say that Jesus was like us in all things but sin. That's a Christian understanding of Jesus. He was like us in all things but sin.
You mean he had no failings, no shortcomings?
No, that's not sin. Sin is where you deliberately miss the mark of being a human being. Sin is where you deliberately diminish your own humanity or the humanity of others. It's not erring. To err is human.
You could turn around that and say actually that sinning is human.
That's exactly the point I'm making. That in fact to sin is to deliberately be less than human. That's what sin is. And so
if we lie, we're less than human.
If we deliberately sin, we're less than human. We're not being as authentic a human being as we potentially can be.
Well, I don't know. You've just constructed an idea of what it is to be a human being.
No. Hold on. What I'm saying is that, well, at least you asked me just what I thought was distinctive about Jesus. What I think is distinctive about Jesus is that we have now, for the first time in human history, we have a human being who doesn't deliberately miss the mark of what it is to be human, against which then we find ourselves realizing that we're fallen. You see, original sin actually is a Christian doctrine, it's not a Jewish doctrine. And we suddenly realize the way we relate to each other, the tit for tat, the reciprocity, the eye for the eye, the tooth for the tooth, is actually not how human beings can and should relate to
one another.
How
about the institution of slavery? How about Jesus, in a sense, approving of slavery, just simply saying, well, you should be nice to your slaves, but he didn't rail against the institution of
slavery. I imagine,
slavery.
Vincent, like yourself, he picked his targets. You know.
Well, that's quite a target now.
Oh, it is. I accept that. And I doubt if you could argue that Jesus was in favour of slavery. In fact, what people experienced in Jesus was complete and total liberation. And that's what we find in the stories again and again.
But why didn't he speak out against the institution of slavery? He said we should be kind to your slaves, not that you should set them free.
Perhaps he did and it wasn't recorded. I don't know. Remember, we're not dealing with biographies here. We're not dealing with history books. We're dealing with faith statements. But if you ask me, is slavery something that Jesus was in favour of or not, I would say absolutely not.
You don't know.
Well, you judge it on the basis of the full picture we get from the Gospels.
Dominic Crossan?
Yeah. Let me go to something that Vincent won't like, because I'm going to say it never happened, but it's absolutely true. In John's Gospel, the key scene between Jesus and Pilate, when Jesus is declaring in his own words what's the difference between the kingdom he's proclaiming and the kingdom that Pilate is incarnating, he brings it down to one thing and one thing only. My kingdom is not of this world, it's not violent. If it was of this world, my guys would be in here trying to get me out. It all comes down to that. Kingdoms of this world is the normalcy of violence. That's why Jesus could not be on slavery. Whether he speaks against it or not is a question of recording. But he is clearly against violence, and he is for nonviolent resistance to evil. He didn't invent it. There were other Jews who had it in the first century besides him. But that, for me, is the heart of the matter, because that's the way Jesus says, that's the difference between me and you, Pilate.
With just a few minutes left, and I just want to raise another issue concerning Christianity, Jesus, and something that the Pope recently said in that speech where he maladroitly, I would have thought, referred to the dialogue between a Muslim and a Byzantine emperor. But he went on in that speech to say something which was really quite startling from another perspective, and it was that Christianity is a merger between the message of Jesus and Greek philosophy. Do you go along with that, Margaret? You didn't notice him saying that.
I did. But I'm afraid... I must say, it didn't appeal to me. I wouldn't regard myself as competent to argue the point with him, but it just was not the way I would particularly like to understand Christianity.
David?
I think if we look at some of the classic statements of Christian faith, like the Nicene Creed, there's absolutely no doubt that it's a merger between older Christian traditions and Greek philosophy. I think at the time that those were written, it articulated how people understood Jesus. Whether, as Sean was saying earlier, it's an appropriate statement of how Jesus was in his own context, or whether it's an appropriate statement for our world today, where by and large we don't think in Greek philosophical terms, those are other questions.
The point he was making really was, which was a very controversial point, and it was that Christianity, unlike Islam, is infused with the idea of reason, the Greek concept of reason, and therefore it was in a higher intellectual plane, he didn't quite put it this way, than the Muslim religion was.
I was unhappy.
You're going to tell that to the Arabic philosophers and mathematicians from whom the Middle Ages learned how to do art.
I'm just it's quoting the Pope.
I found his attribution of that idea of, you know, the logos, the word, to purely to Greek philosophy, rather unsatisfactory, because that idea of Jesus as the word comes out of Jewish reflection on the wisdom of God.
Thank you.
It's a very Semitic concept, in fact. You know, the Jews had this lovely idea that, if you like, that what we can see of God in the world and through God's activity, they call that wisdom, God's wisdom. And they developed a whole kind of personification of a figure of wisdom who, interestingly, was a feminine figure. Yeah. You know, and they had the idea that wisdom, the wisdom of God, came looking for a place to dwell and eventually found Israel and dwelt with the people of Israel. And that's all the background to the word making his dwelling, the
I'm
word
hearing
of God making
words
his
of
dwelling.
Wisdom in my ears telling
me
the time
Jewish.
Telling me the time is up. Thank you all for taking part in the program. The program team tonight was Kevin Barnes, Annette Egan and Michael Campion. From us tonight, good night.
You've been listening to a podcast from RTE Radio 1. For more details, visit rte.ie/radio1.